Happy New Year, and to New York City, happy 100th anniversary. On this date 100 years ago, a five-sided wedding took place. The boroughs of Manhattan, the Bronx, Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island joined together to form this country's biggest city, a city distinguished not merely by size, but by ethos. Historian Kenneth Jackson, a native of Memphis, arrived in New York 30 years ago to teach and study, and says that he was taken with its tolerance.
The great strength of New York is that it's so open, you can do anything you want. Unlike a place like the state of Virginia, where, you know, whether you're a member of the first family, or in Boston, where you're a Brahmin, there's always this sense in New York that in the end, people don't give a damn about your background. The only thing that really counts is what can you do. And so I think it's served as a magnet for outcasts all around the world who think that, well, whatever ethnicity or language or race I bring to the table, in the end, people will judge me about what I can do and how hard I can work and how I can be creative.
New York City, according to a former mayor, is a gorgeous mosaic. But that might suggest too much fixity. In fact, the tiles are forever shifting and being replaced. New immigrant groups move in as old ones fan out into the great national beyond known as out of town. For example, the borough of Queens, which was a county of villages in 1898 when it joined New York. By the time that author and newspaper columnist Jimmy Breslin grew up there, it was a collection of blue-collar bedroom suburbs.
It was a place of firemen, cops, of people living in the first houses they ever had in their lives, who got up to work in the morning and caught, this Jesse Jackson's great phrase, caught that early bus or the early subway. I went into Manhattan. It was to work. A lot of them. It was the back office help for the Wall Street, sanitation, fire, the people who answer the bell, the alarms at night, the nurses, the cops, the emergency service squads, and it was German and Irish, with Catholic Church, very important.
How much has Queens changed over the years?
Well, it's a new place. Queens now, it was 85% white, and now it's about 35% white. Like a woman said to me one day, her name was Quinn, she had a child in a school in the Rosedale section of Queens, and she said, you know, my kid goes to school that's 99% minority. I said, yeah, I don't think it's a minority anymore. There's 129 languages spoken in Queens. In the Flushing section, and then on through neighborhoods called Elmhurst and Jackson Heights that were famous for show business people used to live. It looks like Central America and South America, and it is. The stores give you a feeling that you're in San Jose and Costa Rica. Then you go around the corner, there's a Korean section, and on the second floor, there's a beauty salon, and they have a bank of 9 television monitors that you look up at from the street, and they are showing a young woman having her hair done at this very moment. You're watching live action. That's their idea of advertising, and it's way ahead of anything we're doing.
So the future is in Queens.
Oh, it has to be. No question about it.
It's been said that young people living in the borough of Queens look toward Manhattan, and old people look toward the suburbs in Long Island. No one is really at peace.
NPR's Margot Adler.
Take Ovid Sanders, a senior at Forest Hills High School. He wrote a letter to National Public Radio asking for more from the perspective of Eastern European immigrants. I'm part Greek, part Russian, part Romanian. My parents, he says, don't encourage me to write.
This kid has strayed from the herd, they seem to be saying. He is not doing what we have been doing for generations. There's pity in their eyes. To them, the hammer is a simple, elegant tool, and there's a disarming candor in the screwdriver. How can I, by smuggling words to paper on the kitchen table late at night, beat it?
Ovid Sanders says there are now more than 400 Eastern European immigrants in his high school, and he believes many are bitter.
They'll tell you that the playing field is anything but leveled, that they came here without language skills, Western work skills, or money. The elders in such groups collect meager welfare checks. The middle-aged ones usually work menial jobs. The older members of this group take it as a given of the immigration process. But the young ones are hungry and bitter wolves.
We stand outside Forest Hills High School. It feels like a mini United Nations. There are blacks, whites, Asians, Indians. It's only 1:30 in the afternoon, yet classes are over for many. It's a good school, but crowded, so classes are staggered, and many students begin their day at 7 a.m. We move to a corner where a group of Russian kids are clustered. Avid, dark-haired, and slender, plays reporter.
I'm here like 2 years.
Do you feel that it was that the educational system in this country is better than Russia or worse?
It's a little bit worse than in Russia because what we learn right now, they learn like in sixth or seventh grade.
How do you think the society is toward immigrants from Eastern Europe?
No. Totally unfair. I came here like 9 years ago and everyone's like making fun of me.
What do you want to do in this country knowing that you have much more options about what to become?
Get out of the school and just go work.
Sanders says all the kids are wearing Tommy Hilfiger, Nautica, Ralph Lauren. Image is everything.
It feels like what they think about when they see America is this great look.
But it doesn't take you very far, he says.
They're not looking forward to much besides hanging out with their friends, and when they graduate high school, maybe they'll go to doing labor. I feel kind of like they don't have as good chances as others because of the language barrier. If they don't have their college education, they won't fulfill their parents' dreams, I guess, to do something more in this country.
Sanders tells a story of a kid who says his father eats cholesterol for breakfast, ate eggs because they're cheap. His portrait of resentment seems at odds with what many middle-aged people here remember of growing up in Forest Hills. Arnie Sacker is an intellectual without portfolio. He lives in the neighborhood, helps edit a small literary magazine, and spends much of his time reading, talking. He remembers a very different middle-class Jewish neighborhood when he was a teenager.
You had these very flamboyant Jewish middle-class women who would have, like, the B'nai B'rith and all that, and they'd be almost the Philip Roth caricature. You'd see them in the mink stoles and diamond rings, and they'd run everything.
Most of these people moved to the suburbs, he said, or they're dead, or they moved to Florida. Once largely a Jewish and Italian neighborhood, Forest Hills in the 1980s became a home for new immigrants from Iran, China, Korea, India, Israel, Eastern Europe, and Pakistan. Arnie Sacker says many of his neighbors now are young, busy, working, not easily pigeonholed. They don't wear their identities on their sleeves. It doesn't feel much like a neighborhood, he says. But what Sacker shares with Ovid Sanders is the sense of isolation that comes from living in a place that some people across the river call the outer boroughs.
And there's a kind of a deep depression that you somehow feel in the neighborhood, a resignation. And with the people in Queens, a kind of you don't count feeling. Manhattan is important. Who are we, just these schmucks out here?
It's hard to get his friends to even come to Queens, he says.
Like you're taking a trek to the Egypt. It really does have that feeling. And to that extent, I feel angry.
Anger at being left out. Arnie Sacker and Ovid Sanders live only blocks apart, and their worlds are far different. One is 56, one is 17. Yet both are looking outside their borough and wondering what part they have to play in the world. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
In the realm of mass media-born images, Queens was the home of Archie Bunker. Not much of a source of pride there, but still a far cry from the defamation accorded the borough of the Bronx. Over time, the Bronx has become identified with such urban pathologies as crime, arson, and welfare dependency. It's the place George Steinbrenner wants to get the Yankees out of. To our commentator, Leon Winter, it's something altogether different. It's home.
The Bronx is where New York City extends into America in dream and in truth. It's the only borough connected to the mainland. Major Manhattan arteries flow north through us into the hills and shores of New England in an almost straight line, and with them, a way up for the immigrant working man. Broadway makes a dramatic entrance in the Bronx on the shoulders of a double-decker lift bridge high above the northern neck of the Harlem River, cars on the lower roadway and the number one Broadway train on top. First Avenue becomes Willis, then Melrose, then Webster. Park Avenue is still Park Avenue up here, carrying the railroad line from Grand Central to New Haven, and Third Avenue is still Third. I'm standing near the intersection of Park and Third and Webster at Fordham Road, about as close as you can get to the geographic center of the Bronx without going on safari in the middle of the zoo. This is a spiffy plaza the state just built on an old parking lot where one of the first and few Sears stores in New York was ever built, back when its last name was Roebuck. It still stands. From here, you can walk back in time to Italian New York of the 1950s, or you can hike up the concourse into the thick of haberdashery, sporting goods, and tchotchke shops where Bronx teens buy their first taste of forbidden fruit, tight jeans, pimp hats, push-up bras, and switchblades. Only the names of the stores have changed, and the accents, though not as much as people think. The Dominicans and Jamaicans have brought their Caribbean sing-song patter to Fordham Road, but the Bronx of native black, Jewish, Italian, and Irish Americans still rubs off on them in pizza shops, bagel stores, and public school rooms. Fordham Road is where the South Bronx begins and ends, and likewise the image of the mythical Uber ghetto that masks us from the outside world. That image never penetrated the heart of this place, where Park Avenue meets Sears on the way to America. Ghetto Schmetto, this too is a place where every weekend mechanic needs a good Craftsman socket set, and the wives believe in Kenmore washers bought on store credit. This isn't Fort Apache and it ain't Riverdale either. This is the real Bronx, solid as Sears, though not as dated. You're less likely to be shot here than in much of Washington, D.C., Atlanta, Detroit, or Houston. But if you did catch a bullet, this is the place to be, equidistant from three world-class medical centers. And if you didn't make it, well, you could do worse than be buried on the slopes of Woodlawn Cemetery with Duke Ellington, Irving Berlin, Miles Davis, Herman Melville, F.W. Woolworth, and even J.C. Penney for company, just 2 miles up Webster from here. Black and white, rich and poor, Jew and Gentile have been sleeping side by side in Woodlawn since 1868. That's the feeling of connection and continuity that makes my heart beat for the Bronx. My immigrant grandparents made their stake 2 miles down Webster from here. My parents drove up Webster and Park, picked up their white goods, tires, and power tools at Sears, and proceeded east and north on Fordham and Pelham Parkway to a little pink house of our own, not far from Long Island Sound. We never really wanted for more. I remember riding up the concourse in a darkened limousine after my grandfather died. I was 19, and the reality of death and the fact that my grandpa would be shipped to Jamaica for burial had just hit me. My Aunt Lucy pointed out that he always looked forward to going home, while you, she said coolly, will be buried in the anonymous Bronx. It stung pretty badly at the time, but it's long since worn off. I've been to Brooklyn, to New Haven, Washington, Los Angeles, and back, and the Bronx still feels like all I ever needed. My first child will be born here this spring, and while fatherhood may drag me over the line into Westchester, I look forward to being back in the hills of the Bronx with Miles and Duke one day, anonymous no more. For NPR News, this is Leon Winter in the Bronx.